This presentation was delivered as part of the 2012 Boston Mormon Stories Conference held at Harvard Square in Cambridge, Massachusetts, as organized by the awesome Boston Mormon Stories Support Community. To start or join a support community where you live, click on the Support Communities menu option at mormonstories.org. To plan and host your own Mormon Stories Conference, please email us at mormonstories@gmail.com. And thank you for listening.
On behalf of Mormon Stories, I'd like to welcome you to our first Boston Mormon Stories Conference. Very excited about this. My name is Elizabeth Hammond, and I am a member of the local Mormon Stories group and a member of the Cambridge First Ward. I'd like to express a lot of great and heartfelt appreciation for everybody who was involved in the logistics of pulling off this conference and to people who traveled from long distances to be here. So thank you so much for making the event yesterday possible and today, and tomorrow morning we'll also be meeting again informally if you'd like to hang out and talk some more. On behalf of Boston, I'd like to welcome Mormon Stories here to Harvard Square. Boston, Massachusetts, and the surrounding areas have a deep history of engaging Mormonism in ways that align with today's conference theme, which is using personal narratives to create spaces where Mormons of all levels of orthodoxy can interact authentically. Diversity of belief and practice often poses significant challenges to creating emotionally safe spaces where people can express their perspectives and their experiences out loud. Differences in belief and practice have caused innumerable conflicts in relationships, in both in real life and on the internet, and these conflicts in turn can compromise friendships, ward communities, and the whole spectrum of family relationships. So to prevent such conflict, individuals often will attempt to silence others or choose to remain silent themselves, which has high costs for everyone involved. So the Mormon Stories community seeks to move beyond the notion that a community's members must all agree on belief and subscribe to the same practices. And the goal of our conference is to invite all voices to resonate with each individual's perspective and lived experience without the fear of being dismissed or reproved. And by doing so, we hope to create useful dialogue, preserve relationships, learn from each other, and ultimately create a diverse, inspiring, and productive community of all kinds of Mormons and friends of Mormons. Each of today's speakers has strong lived experience in both participating in and creating these kind of communities that meet these kind of objectives. So no doubt we have in the audience today traditional believing members of the Mormon Church. We probably also have in attendance members of varying levels of Mormon belief, people who have left the church, perhaps even fundamentalists, apologists, atheists, agnostics, and members of other religions. And all people from all these groups, as well as women, men, and all people of all sexual orientations, are equally welcome and have an equal standing in the Mormon Stories community. So to honor and protect everybody here, Mormon Stories conferences are convened in the spirit of the Mormon Stories Shared Values, which I will read now, and which you can find printed on the brochures, the back of brochures of today's conference. Number one, they're not numbered on your brochures, but I'm going to read them as a list here. Number one, we acknowledge the richness of Mormon heritage, teachings, and community in all of its diversity. Number two, we believe that one can self-identify as Mormon based on one's genealogy, one's upbringing, beliefs, relationships, and other life experiences, regardless of one's adherence or non-adherence to the teachings or doctrines of any religious organization. Number three, we seek spaces where we as Mormons can live lives of intellectual and spiritual integrity, individual conscience, and personal dignity. Number four, we acknowledge and honor different spiritual paths and modes of religious or non-religious truth-seeking. We respect the convictions of those who subscribe to ideas and beliefs that differ from our own. Number five, we recognize the confusion, the distress, the emotional trauma, and social ostracism that people on faith journeys often experience. We seek constructive ways of helping and supporting people regardless of their ultimate decisions regarding church affiliation or activity. And finally, number six, we affirm the inherent and equal worth of all human beings. We seek spaces where Mormons and all people can interact as equals regardless of race, gender, or sexual orientation. And in this spirit of egalitarianism, we prefer non-authoritarian and non-hierarchical means of organization and affiliation. I invite you at this time to turn off your cell phones, and please note that the proceedings here are being recorded for later distribution. We will now hear a musical selection by musician Mark Abernathy of the Saber Rattlers, whose work many will recognize as being utilized on the Mormon Stories podcast. Would you like to introduce yourself and your selection?
And to Joanna by special request, and I have to cheat because I haven't sung this in a long time. This is Now Let Us Rejoice.
Now let us rejoice in the day of salvation. No longer as strangers on earth need we roam. Good tidings are sounding to us and each nation. And shortly the hour of redemption will come, when all that was promised, the saints will be given, and none will molest them from morn until eve, and earth will appear as a garden of Eden, and Jesus will say to all Israel, come home. For the day when the Savior will come, and all that was promised, the saints will be given, and none will molest them from morn until eve, and earth will appear as the Garden of Eden, and Jesus will say to all Israel, come home. Jehovah to guide through these last days of trouble and gloom, and after the scourges and harvest are over, we'll rise with the just when the Savior doth come. Then all that was promised, the saints will be given, and they will be crowned with the angels of heaven.
Thank you, Mark. Okay. In the spirit of embracing diversity and creating safe space, we will open our conference with a non-traditional prayer, and that will be offered by Ann Pfeffer.
Dear Heavenly Mother and Father, we thank thee so much that we can be here today and feel thy love for us and share thy spirit and the spirit of love and caring for all. And we thank thee that we have found the internet and have been able to find one another and develop communities here and in other places where all can feel safe and can find a place to speak and share their thoughts regardless and find safety and warmth and home. And we say these things in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
It is now my privilege and honor to introduce this session's keynote speaker, who is a dear friend and mentor of mine. Laurel Thatcher Ulrich is the 300th anniversary university professor at Harvard University and past president of the American Historical Association. She is the author of many articles and books on early American history, including A Midwife's Tale, which won the Pulitzer Prize for History in 1991. Her most recent book is Well-Behaved Women Seldom Make History, A fifth-generation Latter-day Saint, she has published personal essays in, among other places, Dialogue, Exponent 2, The Enzyme, Weber Studies, The Journal of American History, and in an anthology co-authored with Emma Lou Thane called All God's Critters Got a Place in the Choir. She is currently working on a book about 19th-century Mormon diaries. She and her husband, Gail Ulrich, are the parents of 5 children and grandparents of 7. They are active members of the Cambridge First Ward in Massachusetts.
Thank you, Liz, and thanks to Mark and Anne for establishing a wonderful spirit, and I hope I can live up to that. I'm really delighted to be here today, and at the same time, a little intimidated. You know, I feel like the old timer in the room, kind of working on what we used to call the unsponsored sector of Mormonism for more than 30 years, really maybe 40 years, maybe my whole life, who knows. But I'm very excited to connect with such a dynamic group, and a group of people are doing innovative and very important things. Today, because Liz sort of asked me to and kind of gave me a prompt, I am going to talk about history. I'll say a little bit about Mormon history, but I really want to get us thinking a little bit just about history in general and what it means or might mean to people as they contemplate their own lives in the present. And I want to start with a little snapshot of Harvard history. So how many of you out there have ever taken a guided tour of Harvard Yard? Ah, most of you haven't, so you have this experience ahead of you. And if I'm not mistaken, here's what'll happen to you. You get a lot of funny stories from guides, young undergraduate type guides, and you'll probably end up standing in front of a statue of a seated figure that stands in front of University Hall, which is one of the administration buildings. And this statue has the inscription on the base, John Harvard, founder, 1638. Now, your guide will quickly tell you that this statue is known as the Statue of the Three Lies. What are the three lies? First, it isn't John Harvard. The statue was done in the middle of the 19th century. John Harvard died in 1638, and besides, nobody knows what he looks like. Second, he wasn't the founder of Harvard. He was one of the first donors. And doesn't everything get named after a donor? And finally, Harvard was chartered in 1636, not 1638. So that is the statue of the three lies. Now, this is the kind of gotcha history that gets a lot of attention. And I thought maybe I'd imitate it a little bit today by moving across Massachusetts Avenue to the building just beyond us, the main part, the sanctuary building, the Carpenter Gothic building, the gray building that faces Massachusetts Avenue and that is connected to where we are at this moment. I apologize for doing that because this is a wonderful space, both this one and the older part of the building. And the church that inhabits this space does great things. But I'm going to have to tell you, if you go into the front of the building and you look, there's an inscription right beside the very large door that opens off Massachusetts Avenue into the sanctuary. And this inscription makes this the Church of the Three Lies. So what does that inscription say? It says, the first parish in Cambridge, the first church, Unitarian, Universalist, 1633, 1636. It's a fabrication. there were no Unitarian Universalists in 1633 and 1636. The building was built in 1833. And even more interesting, the church that inhabits this building does not have an undisputed claim to being the successor of the little Puritan church of the 1630s. It's actually a really interesting story. In the early 19th century, there was a big squabble over theology. There was a liberal group and a conservative group. And the liberal group won temporarily, and they deposed the existing minister, who was the father of Oliver Wendell Holmes. So the conservative group moved out and renamed themselves the Shepherd Congregational Society, naming themselves after the first minister, the minister of the 1630s, who laid the foundation of the church. And this squabble went on until 1899, when it was finally settled, and when people decided we would have two first churches in Cambridge. And that's right. And you can see it on the markers on this building. There's this church, which is Cambridge First Church Unitarian Universalist. And if you go up around and up Garden Street and go a bit further, you will find Cambridge First Church Congregational. So who's the legitimate heir to this tradition? The conservatives or the liberals? Are neither or both have a legitimate claim to this story? I tell this story to remind us of some important things. First of all, that history, if looked at closely, is very complicated. And it's not only complicated, it's controversial. And it cannot be stuffed into inscriptions or websites or monuments or timelines in the way we often do. It invites us to think about complication. And even though we can't stuff it into these sound bites, that doesn't stop us from trying to do so. We all do, because a claim to history is one of the ways we define ourselves as human beings. History is an ongoing dialogue between present and past. It's about us as much as it's about them in the past. If you think about that, history is the study of how things change. We often talk about the way the past influences and shapes the present and the future, but I don't think we talk nearly enough about how the present shapes the past. Now, we can see that in the mission statements of the two first churches in Cambridge, and I was intrigued that Liz read a mission statement to us for Mormon Stories. Very traditional thing to do. The mission statement for the First Church Unitarian comes across as a little more liberal, perhaps even edgy, than the other, but they're both there, and both of them, I'll let you go to the websites and read them. They're very, very interesting to see this. They both come across with the point of view that they're trying to connect present and past. They're trying to breathe new life into a very old tradition, an ancient tradition with a future mission, I think one of them says. Well, I'd like to push that a little bit further, and I'd like to consider whether we in this room today are also part of the heritage of Cambridge First Church. It's kind of an interesting idea. We're in this space, this is apparently with no connection whatsoever to Mormonism. We're here to tell Mormon stories. What on earth does it have to do with this historical space that we're inhabiting? Well, I think Mormon stories is heir to a very long tradition of what Mormon Stories calls faith formation, what the website for this church calls faith formation, that was exemplified in the history of 17th century Cambridge. You may not know that New England's early Puritan settlers engaged in a particularly rigorous form of storytelling. That is, you couldn't become a member of Cambridge First Church unless you could offer a narrative, a statement about the progress of your soul and the way that you came to an understanding of faith. And the minister, Thomas Shepherd, kept notes. One of the very richest collections of early Puritan faith narratives comes out of these very crabbed notes from Thomas Shepherd. There's something like 61 of these little narratives. And they're full of scriptural references. They're full of theological concepts that probably most of us won't get or understand. But, they're not easy reading either. But there are moments when a little sparkle comes through, at least to me, that makes me recognize something. Even though these are very different for me, they help me to recognize something about my own faith narrative and about narratives of other Latter-day Saints that I know. For example, here's Abram Arrington. The first time the Lord did me any good was what a friend, a godly man, brother Isaac, being at work together, he spake to me how it stood with me about my estate and asked me whether God gave me a heart to seek him. So I told him I had little mind or heart that way. And he then said it was high time to look in it, for now was a fair season. High time, 17th century expression. Isn't that nice to know? Here's Isabel Jackson, Goody Jackson. She did express much how she was afraid of falling away. Having known and been well acquainted with some that had been eminent in profession, that is, profession of faith, had been eminent in profession, yet falling away to the great dishonor of the Lord and scandal in religion, and they being strong and tall cedars, and she but weak and a low shrub. This did much affect her heart. Has that ever happened to you? Have you ever been accused of anything like that? The tall cedar and the lowly shrub, and someone might be falling away. Well, I love the statement of Elizabeth Dunster. I'm sorry to confess, I can relate to this. There's a lot of lamenting about one's sinful state in these narratives, but I really like the way Elizabeth Dunster put it. She said that she found her own heart dead and sluggy. So in gathering his church together in the 1630s, Thomas Shepherd spent a great deal of time listening to people's stories and probably shaping them as well, because none of us tell our stories freely in any setting, including this one. Our stories are shaped by our audience. Our stories are shaped by expectations. And he certainly had expectations for those who wanted to join his church. And telling this story and attempting to identify with faith narratives of people who are very different from me and from my tradition, I want to cross a boundary between present and past. I want to understand them. I want to know why they did the things that they did. But I can't look away from serious problems. I need to acknowledge, for example, that First Church Cambridge in 1637 was the site of a heresy trial, the first in American history. The person on trial was a woman named Anne Hutchinson, who had her own faith narrative. She was banished from the colony, went off and founded Rhode Island, you know, a sink of iniquity down there, as you all know from Rhode Island. But Anne Hutchinson was banished as a heretic because she had the audacity to claim direct revelation from God, which was a no-no. The revelation was to come, their inward heart was important, but it was to come from the means, the Bible, the scriptures, and the preaching of men like Thomas Shepherd. And Hutchinson defied that, and she defied it as well by being a woman and presuming to speak for God. Well, I've gone on quite a distance here, but I want to establish that narratives, personal stories about faith journeys, are one of the most important genres in American literature and in American religious history. They are also one of the most important genres in Mormonism. I was intrigued last evening when Joanna Brooks told us that she had been influenced in part by reading 18th century Quaker women's narratives. And there are many kinds. And these moved into the 19th century with Methodists, with Shakers, with Quakers, with believers of all kinds, and certainly with Latter-day Saints. There are faith narratives often. I'm at the moment studying diaries. This is a high literacy era. And so there are a lot of written stories. But it's interesting, before people begin their daily diary, which usually happens for men when they're called on missions, for women, usually in a moment of transition or crisis. But they often begin with a little narrative about how they came to this point, how they became Latter-day Saints, what had happened to them prior than that. And some of them had been Quakers. Many of them had been Methodists. They come out of a tradition of storytelling that's very powerful. One of my favorite examples, and I wish I could easily go off into the past, which is where I live. I could easily go off and talk for a long time about one of my favorite diaries and one of my favorite autobiographies, which was written by a man named Hosea Stout, some of whose descendants are pillars of the faith in the Boston area even today. Now, Hosea Stout's really interesting because of his unusual background, his unusual upbringing. He was born in South Carolina, but his parents were poor, and they migrated. They moved on to Tennessee and then to Kentucky, and they just had lots of kids, some of whom died. But finally, they just couldn't take care of their family. And so what did they do? They did what a lot of people on the frontier did at that time. They took them to the Shakers. And the Shakers, who were celibate and therefore had no progeny of their own, took in orphans or poor children and raised them. So Hosea Stout and his five siblings went to live in a place called Pleasant Hill in Kentucky. There he learned all kinds of fascinating things. He learned to speak softly. He learned not to run and be wild. He learned to obey grown-ups, and he learned to confess his sins daily, lest he be shut up in the root cellar, which must have been really terrifying. He also learned to fear individual bonds. The allegiance was to be to the community. And this became a crisis for him one day when his mother came to visit him, bringing the little brother that had been born after the children had been placed out with him. And he writes, "She would bring apples and other little articles to please me. And I remember that she took me outdoors once to have a talk with me and give me an apple, telling me to be a good boy and had me to sit there lest the other boys might get it away from me. And I reluctantly went out with her and was in a hurry to go in again lest the boys might think I loved her. For we were taught to spurn the idea of paternal affection. But when he was 8 or 9 years old, his father came to take him back. And it's this reaction that I think is so interesting. He was absolutely terrified because he had learned that terrible things happen among the worldlings, and that the worldlings didn't have enough to eat, and that he was likely to starve if he went back. But when he discovered that this wasn't the case, that there was enough to eat among the worldlings, and there were ponds to play in and lots of things to do, he tells us he learned to swear and fight and jump in the mill race like the other boys, and he began to resent being called a Shaker boy. Now, here's a little guy who has a real identity conflict here. Where does he belong? What's going to happen? And his solution was Mormonism. He was joyous when he found the Latter-day Saints, because with them, he was able to affirm material life. The Mormons valued obedience and unity, but they had fun. And they even took a few passes at the whiskey jug, we find from Hosea Stout. Even some of the 12 apostles joined him in a drink nip once in a while. Many people, many diarists, talked about the liberation that they felt when joining a people that not only prayed, but taught them that they mattered. They not only mattered, but they were gods in embryo. And even more important, that they might be connected to all those dead relatives. This was a period of extraordinarily high mortality. And there's probably no single doctrine that came into the church at that point that meant more and that was more quickly embraced than baptism for the dead, which is really fascinating to me as we've watched the current controversy about this. Nobody had to teach it. They just grabbed it because it solved a problem about connectedness to family. Okay, so Mormonism then was a liberating force for many Latter-day Saints. It also demanded a lot, but it was an interesting system because people were baptized one minute and sent off to preach the gospel the next. And you really wonder what they preached. What did they know? Well, there's one thing they did know, and this is important, and this brings me right back to First Church. For many years, the older part of this building was the place where Harvard held its commencement. There's a very tight relationship between the college and the church. And in 1837, the Phi Beta Kappa Society invited a young Unitarian minister named Ralph Waldo Emerson to give the address, and we have somebody who's a guide at the Emerson House. If you have time, you can go out to Concord and see it. And his lecture, which became known as the American Scholar, became known as the Intellectual Declaration of Independence for American writers. Walt Whitman said it set him boiling. It liberated writers. It liberated artists. We no longer have to look to Europe. We can speak with our own voices. We can talk, write with our own hands. We can tell our own stories, American stories. And I want to just give you two quotes because I think Oh, I'll just tell you part of my autobiography. I love this because, you know, I'm kind of a child of the late 50s and 60s. And this spoke to me. I practically memorized Walden. But here's Emerson in the Phi Beta Kappa address. Meek young men grow up in libraries, believing it their duty to accept the views which Cicero, which Locke, which Bacon have given, forgetful that Cicero, Locke, and Bacon were only young men in libraries when they wrote these books. We can do it too. And then he totally outraged his fellow Unitarians the next year by giving a talk to the graduates of the Divinity School. We've got a Divinity School person here, and I'm sure you've heard this story, where he said, "It is the office of a true teacher to show us that God is, not was, that he speaketh, not spake. The true Christianity, a faith like Christ in the infinitude of man, is lost. None believeth in the soul of man, but only in some man or person old and departed." This was a religious declaration of independence. And I love the way Dick Bushman uses this Divinity School address in the preface to Rough Stone Rolling. I mean, he says pretty bluntly, you know, Emerson didn't embrace Joseph Smith. He wasn't the kind of prophet he was looking for. But he was attacking what he thought were the desiccated traditions of his own society, which were so turned to the past that they had lost the spirit which created the past. And he wanted to use history and religion to create more history and more religion. Bushman writes, "Had Emerson looked, he would have found thousands of kindred spirits among unsophisticated Christians who longed for visions, visitations, inspired dreams, revelations, and every other outpouring of the Spirit. These seekers were Joseph's natural constituency." The power of the Latter-day Saint movement is that sense that God speaks. Wasn't in the past. It's in the present. And that the American continent and that the ordinary people had a place, had a kind of destiny in fulfilling God's purpose. So, where does that bring us? History is the study of how things change. In period of intense social or personal struggle, it can overwhelm us with its strangeness, or it can empower us with its opportunities. I was really kind of blown away when I discovered that in the fascinating survey that Mormon Stories did, that history was listed as one of the obstacles. That Mormon history was a problem to people. I didn't understand that, because Mormon history was such a strength to me throughout my life and my faith. And I was really puzzled by that and very sad. And then I thought about an experience I had, and that's what I'd like to close with, just telling you about this interesting experience that I had with my granddaughter. I have my daughter and her family live in Southern California, so we don't see them a lot. And I think it might have been 6 or 8 years ago. It was a while. We were visiting them, And I was sitting at a kind of picnic table outside. You know, it's Southern California. You're outdoors. It's great. You're waiting for your fast food. Southern California, it's beautiful and it's fast food. Okay, so we're sitting there waiting for our order in the restaurant. And I'm trying to make conversation with my 12-year-old granddaughter. And I opened my bag, and inside was a little program that I had gotten from attending a Mormon Historical Society meeting, in which there had been a wonderful program on the poetry of Eliza R. Snow. And I thought, oh, she'd like this. So I showed it to her and said, let me tell you about this neat thing that we did. He said, Alina, do you know who Eliza R. Snow is? And Alina paused, and then she said, oh, is she Lorenzo Snow's wife? And I thought, boy, some primary teacher got her to memorize the names of the presidents of the church. I was really impressed. And I said, no, she's Lorenzo Snow's sister, but she was Joseph Smith's wife. And her eyes got very big, and she looked at me, and she said, well, I thought he already had a wife. And I said, well, he had quite a few wives. And then I thought, oh, my goodness, what have I done here? I could not believe that my granddaughter, who was descended on many sides from 19th century polygamists, didn't know that Joseph Smith had more than one wife. I was just stunned. And I came back thinking, my goodness, we got a problem here where people don't know our own history. But then I thought, well, why am I surprised? Because I was in my 30s. Before I knew there was a women's rights movement in Utah in the 19th century, and that there was a publication called The Woman's Exponent, and that Utah women, as Mormon women, were among the first in the nation to vote. I didn't know that. And so what that brings me back to is the point with which I began, the way in which the present shapes the past. So we can only know what is accessible to us in the generation in which we live. And institutions shape history, not individuals, by and large. Institutions shape history. And the history that we need is not always the history that we get. Which is why I think we should be supporting Mormon Stories. Not just because it talks about us. You know, people get to talk about themselves. But because we're creating, I'm thrilled to know from John, Anne, and others, creating an archive. An archive as powerful as that of, more powerful than that of Thomas Shepard. And that it includes a wide range of voices and a wide range of faith journeys. And that as we tell our own stories, maybe we can turn more attentively and more industriously to the stories of those who came before us and to understand why things that seem weird to us seemed marvelous and wonderful to them. Thank you.
And I'd like to invite Mark up again to perform for us one more time, please.
Brightly beams our Father's mercy. From his lighthouse, evermore. But to us, he gives the keeping for the light's long shore. Let the lower lights be burning. Send a gleam across.
Cola in there in the microphone. I've got a nasty cough, so. You guys want to hear another one? You want to take a break?
Elisa.
You know, actually, the Bushmans are in our wards, and she's on my case to learn some of these tunes. I don't know that one offhand, but. Let's see, I could do a poor wayfaring man of grief. Anybody wants to hear that? Okay. Jesus Savior, pilot me. go where you want me to go. Does anybody want to hear that one?
It may not be on the mountain's height or over the stormy sea. It may not be on the battle's front. My Lord will have need of me. But if by still small voice calls to pass, I do not know. I'll answer, dear Lord, with my hand in yours. I'll go where you want me to go. I'll go where. Perhaps today there are loving words which Jesus would have me speak. There may be now in the paths of sin some wonder whom I should see. Oh, Savior, if thou wilt be my God, though dark and rugged the way, my voice shall echo the message sweet. I'll say what you want me to say. I'll go where you want me to go, dear Lord, over mountain or plain or sea.
Okay, great. It's now my privilege to introduce John DeLynn. John is a candidate in clinical counseling psychology at Utah State University. He is the executive director of Mormon Stories and host of the Mormon Stories podcast. So welcome. Come on up to Boston. Thank you.
I just want to take a brief second to thank so many people. I want to thank Liz Hammond and Tom Goodsell and Danielle and Jared Mooney and Ann Pepper for organizing this event. Very, very grateful for the time and effort you guys have put forth. And there are others that I'm forgetting, but to all of you, thank you. I want to thank Mark for your beautiful music. It's so powerful, and I'm just so honored to be associated with your art. I want to thank Laurel and Joanna both for coming here to speak to us. Both of you have just been incredible inspirations to me, and I want to thank you for that. And I want to thank all of you for coming today. I'm going to read my talk today. If you'll forgive me.
Words cannot adequately describe how much I love Mormonism, nor how much Mormonism has enriched my life. The loving home ward of my Katy, Texas childhood, the primary songs, the scout campouts, and the fathers and sons outings, the countless games of basketball played on those blasted carpeted cultural hall floors gave me carpet burn when I fell down. The loving primary teachers, youth leaders, and bishopric members, early morning seminary, the stake dances, dance festivals and road shows, youth conferences and testimony meetings, my mission, and most importantly, the thousands of loving, humble church members that I've come to know over the past four decades. So many happy memories for me. So much Mormon joy and love. When it came time to apply to college, in spite of numerous opportunities at several fine Texas universities, only one application was submitted, and that was BYU. Get married in the temple? Check. Have lots of kids? Check. Start the cycle all over again with my own four children? Check. I was and am a Mormon through and through. Just as Joanna calls herself Mormon girl, I still think of myself foremost as a Mormon boy. As you might imagine, never in my wildest good Mormon boy teenage dreams could I have envisioned a time when I would feel cognitive dissonance about the church I love. But that's where I found myself in 2001, working for Microsoft in Seattle, teaching early morning seminary, waking up at 5 a.m. to prepare lessons for those beautiful, young Issaquah, Washington High School Mormon minds, trying to inspire them just as I had once been inspired in those high school days. After 4 years of seminary, 4 years of BYU religion courses, I thought I knew about the tougher aspects of Mormonism because I knew about Brigham's polygamy. I lived through the black priesthood ban, and I sort of knew about the Adam God theory and blood atonement. So I knew all there was to know. Turns out I knew very little. And so it was that in spite of 30 plus years of weekly church education, including 4.5 years at BYU, I discovered for the first time as a seminary teacher in Issaquah, Washington, in my 30s, some very troubling things. Namely, that the Book of Abraham translation, and I put that in quotes, didn't resemble in any way its source. That Joseph Smith didn't translate the Book of Mormon per se, but instead appeared to channel it by placing his head in a hat, peering at a magic stone, most often without the plates even being in the room, as I understand it. I had no inkling that Northern and Mesoamerican archaeological records, along with the newly emerging DNA evidence, provided precious little support and indeed a mountain of credible and serious evidence against the historicity of the Book of Mormon, at least as I understood it. I did not know that Joseph Smith had 30-plus wives, many of whom were already married to other men when he took them as brides, something without the knowledge, sometimes without the knowledge of their husbands or even Emma, that some of these wives were as young as 14 or 15, and that Joseph publicly denied his practice of polygamy when asked about it, and that when the practice was finally publicly exposed, that he tried his best to destroy the evidence. This was hard stuff to learn. Looking back, perhaps the most egregious recognition of all was at the issues surrounding women in the church. The gay and lesbian community and Native Americans didn't even appear on my radar until years after that Issaquah experience. I want you all to know that as I enumerate this list, the Mormon boy in me rises up to say, no, John, no. These are things you should not speak about publicly. We don't talk about these things openly as Mormons. You are planting seeds of doubt. Doubt is bad. You are driving the spirit away. But there's another very Mormon part of me as well, a voice that's even louder and stronger than the fear and shame-based voice that urges me, courage take for goodness sake. it reminds me, oh, say what is truth, 'tis the fairest gem. And it assures me, do what is right, let the consequence follow. This Mormon boy inside of me stands up firm and tall and strong to say that the truth has nothing to hide, nothing to fear, and that we have to learn to talk about difficult things openly as a people, because we as Mormons believe in being honest, and most of all, because people are being hurt and lives are being torn apart by not talking about these things. I could be wrong, but sometimes I like to imagine that in places like Cambridge, Massachusetts, or Berkeley, California, Mormons are provided with the intellectual and psychological tools to handily deal with such issues, whether through philosophy, nuance, metaphor, compartmentalization, or perhaps even through the time-worn trappings of habit, status, and privilege. Maybe to many of you here, these issues are either old news, uninteresting, or irrelevant to your Mormon journeys. And while I have had the good pleasure of getting to know several highly sophisticated, lettered, culturally blue-blooded, and yet still believing Latter-day Saints, such as Bill Bradshaw, Richard and Claudia Bushman, Judy Dushku, Mary Bradford, Marlon Jensen, Terrell Givens, Phil Barlow, Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, and others, my experience over the past 11 years with Mormon Stories has taught me very, very clearly that these issues are new to and do not sit very well with the younger rising generations within Mormonism. These issues matter. They are not going away. There are mounting casualties. And it seems like we need to learn to talk about them publicly. We ignore them at our own peril as a faith tradition. Perhaps there was a time when Lowell Bunyan and T. Edgar Lyon, Leonard Arrington and Eugene England, Mary Bradford and Hugh Nibley, Sunstone and Dialogue, Exponent and Farms, the Mormon Historical Association, even the Church History Department, all had enough of a critical mass of participation and influence, such as to help guide us through these intellectual, cultural, and religious landmines, only to emerge on the other side with our faiths intact, perhaps even stronger than before. For whatever it's worth, this was the role that Philip Barlow's book entitled A Thoughtful Faith, and specifically the role that Richard Pohl's essay, What the Church Means to People Like Me, Laurel Thatcher Ulrich's essay, Lusterware, and Eugene England's essay, Why the Church is as True as the Gospel, played for me for over a decade. They were my lifelines to a thoughtful faith and to church activity. Those Camelot years of church history in the 60s, 70s, and early 80s must have been grand. And how beautiful it might have been for me as a BYU student in the late 80s, to proudly step into that glorious intellectual LDS tradition that those brave women and men laid out for us. By the time I got to BYU, however, a dark cloud of fear had already been cast over these, quote, alternative voices and symposia. Sunstone and Dialogue were whispered to be dangerous. Professors were being let go from BYU, professors that I loved, and scholars were being excommunicated. Ultimately, it appears as though the institutional LDS Church made the decision to metaphorically step on the throats of many of these individuals and institutions by either marginalizing, intimidating, or silencing their voices, leaving an entire generation or two, our generation, without any locatable role models for a deeper, more thoughtful approach to believing Mormonism. Consequently, many of us wandered, directionless, for a decade or more, knowing in our hearts and minds that something was wrong, but not knowing what to do about it, nor whom to turn to look for support and guidance. This was the environment that I found myself in the early 2000s. When I tried to talk to my family, friends, and fellow ward members and bishops about these things that I learned as a seminary teacher, I too discovered landmines at every turn. Outside of my own circle of relationships, I could find precious few role models or practical resources to help me through this crisis of faith. On the internet, I found two types of resources. Those that seem to want to mock and ridicule belief, attempting to convince me to abandon the church and Mormonism and belief altogether. And apologetic resources that seem to want to bend over backwards in less than credible ways to convince me to continue in my Orthodox belief, relying far too often on ad hominem attacks and logic that excessively strained reason and credibility for me. But most importantly, I did not want to be convinced of anything. If possible, I wanted to find strivingly neutral, not overly academic resources that would allow me to get a general understanding of the major issues and allow me to form my own heartfelt conclusions, because I did not want to live on borrowed light, and the stakes are too high. And since I couldn't find those resources anywhere, I decided to create some. As unworthy as I am to attempt such a task. And that's how Mormon Stories was born. Over the past 7 years, with Terry Gross from NPR's Fresh Air and Charlie Rose as role models, I've tried my hardest to interview all types of Mormons on Mormon Stories podcast, apologists and apostates, celebrities and common folk, women and men, gay and straight, young and younger, black and white, bond and free. Okay, I'm getting a little bit carried away. In all of this, I was attempting to explore most of the major issues within liberal Mormonism, including polygamy, racism, sexism, homophobia, apostasy, etc. To date, we've amassed over 400 hours of audio and video content, and the demand only seems to be increasing, with some episodes being downloaded as many as 50,000 times within only a month of release. Many have questioned the motives of me and of Mormon Stories over the past several years, which is fair, because in all honesty, our motives have changed over time. At first, the goal was quite neutral, simply to explore the issues at hand in an open and honest way. Once we discovered, however, that simply exposing people to these difficult issues could result in their disaffection from the church, we actually shut down the podcast for a time, not wanting to be responsible for that possible outcome. Several months after, we realized that people were going to discover these issues with or without our podcast, thanks to Google and The Daily Show and Stephen Colbert and everything else. And that they were going to be able to discover, they were going to discover these issues often in less constructive venues. And most importantly, we discovered that people sorely missed what we were offering and they begged us to bring it back. And so we did. We brought the podcast back and continued the journey. To be candid, as I've learned more and more about our church's history and culture, I, too, have continually struggled with my own LDS testimony, sometimes falling into inactivity, sometimes missing church fellowship and returning to fellowship, sometimes wanting to convince the whole LDS world to stay in the church, and other times feeling so much anger and betrayal that I felt more like burning the whole thing to the ground. Though I have tried to remain neutral during my interviews and all this, I am aware that my biases have consistently shown through, which I often lament. At least we tried. The response to Mormon Stories has truly been humbling. I will never forget the day when an early listener, my dear friend Russell, who's here today, traveled from Brooklyn, New York to Logan, Utah, just to have breakfast with me, a perfect stranger. And to leave me with an envelope filled with five $100 bills. to express his gratitude. I don't mean to embarrass you, Russell, but it was at that moment when I first realized how much pain there was out there around these issues and how desperately people were clamoring for support. Since 2005, I've personally met with, spoken to, or corresponded via email with easily over 5,000 Mormons throughout the world. And the stories are even more humbling. The daughter of a current general authority who cuts herself with a razor blade as a way to cope with the anxiety that she feels at church and within Mormon culture. She feels inadequate as a wife and as a mother. She's terrified to tell her parents what she really thinks and feels because of their position in the church. And she doesn't want to disappoint the people she loves. A proud father of three from the Netherlands, who felt so isolated and guilty and trapped in his disbelief that he began intentionally running lights in his car, sometimes with his family in the car, to try to escape the pain. Countless people who have been ostracized from their families of origin, whose marriages have been dissolved and whose children have been taken from them, lost custody, their only sin being that they happened to read the wrong books and were not able to reconcile the information that they encountered. Armies of young and middle-aged men who refer to themselves as addicts, attending church-sponsored 12-step programs, speaking of their lives and measuring their lives in terms of weeks of sobriety, feeling dirty and unworthy, having lost the ability to take the sacrament or attend the temple, all for the very common act of occasionally masturbating, sometimes as infrequently as once every 3 or 4 weeks. Many of these men have carried intense, and probably women, although I haven't met them yet, have carried intense and debilitating guilt and shame with them since their childhood days when their parents discovered them for the first time. As they have tried with a long line of bishops to repent of their sins, while thousands of others just like them simply aren't asked and don't tell, yet secretly live with that same shame and guilt inside for lying about it or hiding it. Hundreds of young and middle-aged gay and lesbian saints who were promised by their bishops and the good people at Evergreen that if they would just try extra hard to believe in the full power of the atonement, accept that mission call, marry that righteous young woman in the temple, that their same-sex attraction would be taken from them, only to discover that those feelings did not go away as promised, turning the blame to themselves, leaving them wondering if life really was worth living, since there's clearly no place for them in the church if they desire the same level of intimacy that the rest of us find is essential to healthy and happy living. And finally, emails from sitting bishops, Relief Society presidents, Stake High counselors, Stake and Mission presidents, and even one former general authority, all who no longer believe that the church is what they thought it was, but who quietly keep everything to themselves, fearing the consequences of openness and honesty, often living quiet lives of desperation, not wanting to disturb other people's faiths. These are the types of people that came out of the woodwork when we started Mormon Stories. And with the advent of social media, their numbers are only increasing. As mentioned previously, we once launched an initiative called StayLDS.com, and it's still up today, to help keep these people in the church. That was our goal for several years, to keep people in the church, only to find that for so many, once they were able to thoughtfully and independently consider all of the available evidence, that the data simply didn't add up for them. It failed the smell test. The church's historical narrative, combined with its current positions towards gays, women, scientists, intellectuals, failed to pass the credibility test for them. And staying active simply wasn't an option. Not because they were weak, not because they desired to sin, not because they didn't love or care about Mormonism, but because to do so would violate their own sense of integrity and to be complicit in what they have come to believe is a non-credible institution. To whom are these people supposed to turn? 55% of them leave the church as atheist or agnostic. Most of their family, friends, ward members, and bishops remain largely unaware of the issues. They're not trained. When the issues are raised, these people are often met with resistance, resentment, hostility, sometimes isolation. And to train the church members and leaders on these issues would likely only serve to spread the infection, so to speak. And so these people continue to suffer in silence, or as they face the very difficult choice of separating themselves from the church, from their beliefs, and ultimately from their God. And a podcast can only do so much. At the end of the day, people need warm bodies with names, face-to-face connections to weather the storms of this unorthodox and sometimes post-Mormon journey. Last year, with the irreplaceable help of Ann Pfeffer, who's up here at front, and Joanna Brooks, and many other volunteers, we began to hold these conferences, just like this one, all across the country to provide safe spaces for these wonderful, courageous souls. From New York to San Diego, Boise to Atlanta, from Houston to Washington, D.C., the response has been stunning and humbling. Similarly, over 80 Facebook communities have been created across the globe, including in England, Sweden, Brazil, Canada, and dozens of cities across the United States. All across the globe, these communities of misfit Mormons, sometimes active, sometimes inactive, some believing, many disbelieving, are organizing book clubs, playdates, dinner groups, and other meetups, literally from sea to shining sea. For the first time in their lives, they are meeting others who understand them, who love them unconditionally, regardless of their belief or their church activity status, and who are willing to have real, meaningful, authentic conversations and forge deep personal connections. Has the experience been idyllic? Hardly. Turns out it is very, very difficult to bring together believing, exploring, and disaffected Mormons into a single group. Conversations often turn strident or negative. Believers often feel ridiculed or mocked. Disbelievers can often become highly defensive because they feel wounded and angry. Personalities clash, feelings get hurt, fractions and schisms abound. Dogs and cats start sleeping together. This is very, very hard work, but it has also been deeply meaningful and beautiful to behold when it does work. At the end of the day, the most important thing we've learned in these communities is that we must figure out a way to foment a community culture where both belief and disbelief are not only accepted, but are valued and embraced unconditionally. Again, regardless of level of orthodoxy or belief in the church. Where semi-believers or disbelievers can bring their fully believing spouses or family members, and all can feel safe to express their thoughts, feelings, and experiences without the fear of being judged or marginalized or ridiculed. This is the key to our future in Mormon Stories, if we have a future at all. So where do things stand today? I'll offer a few observations. Observation number one, it is worth noting that the LDS Church has clearly begun to respond to this situation, as evidenced by the Joseph Smith Papers Project, the wide promotion of Richard Bushman's Rough Stone Rolling at Deseret Book, the release of the Mountain Meadows Massacre book and its semi-apology, the Church's increasingly nuanced and sometimes even empathetic positions and policies regarding gays and lesbians. Its response to the Randy Bott fiasco was quite encouraging for many, along with several internal church initiatives that are currently in development, of which I will not speak here. Clearly, the church has noticed the situation and is working very hard to respond appropriately. Observation number two, many of us stand in a perpetual state of awe over the fact that none of our own throats have been metaphorically stepped on by church leadership up to this point. We've been doing this now for 7 years. I've had very candid conversations with my bishop, my stake president, and two general authorities about our efforts, and have never been told to stop what we're doing. In some cases, I've actually been encouraged to keep doing what I've been doing. In other instances, I've only been cautioned to be careful. Are the days of disciplinary councils for liberals officially over within the church, or simply on a temporary hiatus until after November? Will the church clamp down on us? Will the church clamp down on us in what we're trying to accomplish? It will be interesting to see. I'm cautiously hopeful in this regard. Observation number 3. Based on several non-scientific data points, including our Why Mormons question survey of 3,000 participants, emails we have received, web hits, podcast downloads, Facebook friend invites, and recent demographic analyses by social scientists like Ryan Cragen, we observed that this phenomenon continues to grow at an accelerated rate. As Elder Marlon Jensen recently stated, quote, maybe since Kirtland, we've never had a period of, I'll call it apostasy, like we're having now, unquote. This has been our experience as well. Observation number 4. Our prediction is that Mitt Romney's recent success at securing the Republican nomination will only accelerate this phenomena. As confirmed by the unusually high number of media inquiries we have received over the past several months, fasten your seatbelts, folks. It's going to be a wild ride over the coming months and maybe years. To conclude, I'd like to end with a list, as clearly as possible, the questions that we're trying to ask and help constructively answer with the work of Mormon Stories and the Open Stories Foundation. Number 1, given that the LDS Church has done so much good and has meant so much to so many people, are there things we can do to help minimize the unhealthy or darker aspects of LDS Church participation in ways that do not unnecessarily weaken the institutional church? Our efforts are rooted in a deep love for the institutional Mormon church, and even more so for its beautiful members. We only endeavor to be a constructive part of the solution. Number 2, given the historical, scientific, social, and cultural problems within Mormon theology, doctrine, history, and practice, we are asking, is there a credible path of thoughtful Mormon belief and practice that would allow thinking Mormons to engage within the LDS Church in ways that preserve their integrity and their emotional, psychological, and physical well-being? If so, we want to help uncover it. I, for one, would warmly embrace such a discovery because I miss the warmth, comfort, security, and simplicity of my Mormon beliefs and my fully active participation in the church. Number 3, for those who are no longer able to believe literally in Mormon doctrine or theology, is there still a place for them within the institutional church or some derivative thereof, wherein they can meaningfully engage in some form of Mormon church experience that doesn't leave them feeling like second-class citizens, that doesn't cause psychological harm, and that doesn't leave them feeling like their integrity has been compromised? Just as Judaism and Catholicism have found ways to bend to accommodate a wide spectrum of belief and disbelief, orthodoxy and unorthodoxy, within their churches and synagogues, can the Mormon church experience, whatever its form, find ways to bend and stretch to avoid losing a sizable and growing portion of its population? A population that includes, in the tear-filled words of Elder Marlon Jensen, many of its best and brightest. Number 4, for those who are either no longer able to or interested in remaining active participants in the LDS Church, is there a path wherein they can still remain culturally identified as Mormons and even experience a sense of benefit to their belonging within the broader Mormon community and culture that is still psychologically beneficial to them, just as the Jews seem to have been able to do themselves? And can these good people transition away from the church without facing the strong levels of isolation, guilt, shame, and ostracization that they so often experience today. Can we keep more marriages and families from being split asunder as these good people follow their hearts and consciences away from church participation? And finally, regarding those for whom any form of religious or even Mormon identity, belief, and practice is no longer tenable, can we help to develop some sort of replacement for organized religion in their lives that retains or even extends all of the cultural, social, familial, moral, psychological, and spiritual benefits of religious participation? Even to believers, these are God's children, and they deserve the benefits. They deserve to live happy lives. These are the questions we're asking at Mormon Stories and the Open Stories Foundation. And these are the things we're trying to answer. And while there are many aspects of my Mormon testimony that have fallen by the wayside over the past 11 years, there are other aspects that are stronger and clearer to me now than anything I've ever experienced or believed in my life. And so I'll close with the remaining remnants of my Mormon testimony. I know that if God exists, she and he can be found in and squarely behind the work that we're doing, even though we do it humbly. I know that the LDS Church has been and continues to be an incredibly positive force in the lives of millions of people around the world. We don't deny that. We don't seek to weaken it. We don't seek to tell it what to do or to counsel it. We don't judge the brethren and the difficulties of the decisions that they have to make. We know that it's very hard to make these decisions, and we don't trivialize the difficulty of those decisions. We try not to. I know that the Mormon people, true believers, liberals, feminists, fundamentalists, Jack Mormons, post-Mormons, ex-Mormons alike, are beautiful and good-hearted people. I know that the LDS Church and its culture sometimes cause deep and significant pain and suffering to certain groups of people, however unintentional it may be. There are people who have tough things to say about Joanna and me and many of those who have been trying to engage in these efforts. But I know that we are only trying to do what's right. We're only trying to follow our hearts and help those who are in need. We're only trying to do our small part to preserve the best of the Mormon tradition that we've inherited. We do not want to lose this tradition. We do not want to lose our people, our culture, our heritage. We want to save it. We want to preserve it, and we want to make it stronger. That's what we're trying to do. I know that working to alleviate this pain and suffering and to help people in their Mormon faith transitions is one of the most holy and joyous pursuits that someone from our great Mormon tribe can engage in this life. And finally, I know with every fiber of my being that the answers to these questions that I've laid out today can be found within the very scripture, doctrine, and values that we have inherited from our Mormon foremothers and forefathers. We know how to do hard things as Mormons. We know how to work. We know how to be pioneers. But most importantly, we know how to love. And so we only need to apply our brilliant Mormon minds, and most importantly, our loving Mormon hearts, to find the answers to these questions. Thank you.
We're going to close this session, move next door to the foyer room for refreshments and to socialize. Mark Abernathy has CDs that he will be able to sell, and we encourage you to support his art and his efforts. I believe we'll also have a sign-up sheet so that you can be on the mailing list and receive information about the Saber Rattlers. I also want to quickly mention that tomorrow morning we have reserved the space on MIT campus in Kendall Square. And the room that we have is probably the best view of Boston you'll ever see, so please consider coming to that. We'll now adjourn and be meeting here again in about 20 minutes, 30 minutes. We'll tell you when to come back. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. Tis better far for us to strive our useless cares from us to drive, to the sand joy your hearts will swell. Should we die before our journey's through?